This episode is brought to you by Knix, the Canadian pioneers of leak-proof underwear. Use code REBEL10 for 10% off when you shop online at knix.ca.
Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Rebel Mama Hotline. As you know, we've always got our ear to the ground to source hot topics for the show, and today's topic is no different. Adolescent mental health.
Adolescence is a phase that we're currently staring down.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing a lot of resource gathering on this topic these days, and where better to glean information than from an expert?
And thank God we found one. Today, we're grateful and excited to welcome Myra Fahim to the pod.
Myra Fahim holds a Master's of Science in Psychology and a Master's of Social Work, along with a Bachelor's of Education, and is registered with both the Ontario College of Teachers and the Ontario College of Social Workers and Social Service Workers. She has additional certificates in trauma counseling, child and youth mental health, smoking cessation interventions, applied suicide intervention skills training, and adult online learning.
Myra has worked in the field of mental health and addictions, largely in nicotine dependence, for 13 years, and is currently a manager in a mental health and addictions hospital. She also has a private clinical practice where she largely supports youth and young adults with a variety of challenges, including mood and anxiety disorders, substance use, self-esteem, and disordered eating behaviors. Myra is additionally a mental health consultant, providing support for program development and facilitating training focused on mental health in the workplace, as well as crisis response.
She also happens to be an old friend of mine dating back to middle school.
Wow.
So welcome to the Rebel Mama Hotline, Myra.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
There's so much you specialize in that we want to talk to you about, and we have so many questions. But before we dive in, we're going to take a quick word from our sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by Knix. Knix is a pioneer in the leak-proof underwear category. They've set out to create garments that transform how you feel, whether it's their lightweight anti-chafing shorts, wireless bras that are sexy and supportive, or overnight period protection. They now offer a variety of products, both leak-proof and not.
In addition to their signature leak-proof underwear, they offer leak-proof pads, leak-proof swim options, leak-proof active, and leak-proof maternity options.
Shop Knix online at knix.ca, and don't forget to use code REBEL10 at checkout for 10% off.
And we're back with mental health expert Myra Fahim. Thanks for being here with us. Let's start out with something pretty general. What are some of the issues you're dealing with most frequently in your practice?
So that's a big question. And that kind of changes. It depends on who you're working with. I work largely with like youth, young adults, and a big thing that's just kind of consistent is issues of depression and anxiety. When I've worked in emergency room kind of crisis response, that's the thing we're seeing a lot, as well as disordered eating is a big one that's coming up, becoming more prevalent, and that ties into a whole bunch of other things. But really, depression, anxiety is just, there's just so much going on in the world. We have so much access to information, and people are just struggling with how to process and deal with everything at hand. So those, I would say, are the biggest. And then we have kind of things around just my experience. So I work with a lot of individuals who deal with substance use, whether that's, you know, vaping, cannabis, alcohol, et cetera. But yeah, I would say the biggest, depression and anxiety for sure.
Having said that, I'm having a hard time processing and coping as, you know, a 43-year-old woman. I can't imagine what that's like in this world for an adolescent.
Yeah. With
all the information and social media and the things they have access to.
Yeah, they're growing up in such a different time
than
what we did. But actually, on the topic of social media, can we talk about that for a second? What are you seeing in terms of its real life effect on kids? And how do you recommend that parents manage this beast of an issue?
I can see she has thoughts.
I know.
She's like, I got thoughts.
You know what? I have thoughts as, you know, like a social worker, clinician, and then I have thoughts as a parent who's a parent to young kids. And even with my kids being young, I'm already terrified. Like, I'm not terrified now. I'm terrified of what I'm going to have to deal with when we get there. And I think it's just the big challenge is that we as parents, because I'll put myself in kind of a parent's shoes, that we may have not grown up with these things, right? So we don't fully understand them. Society doesn't fully understand the effects. So, you know, trying to decide what does social media mean? How do we talk to our kids about it? When should our kids get access to it? And all of those things can become really challenging because we don't fully understand it and the repercussions. And, you know, I joke, like I'm too old for TikTok, for example. And then I think, well, that's
same. Say, so are we.
It's too overwhelming. And I think of, okay, well, my daughter, by the time she gets there, is going to be dealing with those kinds of platforms. And then now I'm needing to make a decision as to, you know, when we talk about and when we introduce things that I don't understand. So even just coming around to the fact that, like, in order for us to be able to engage in those conversations with our kids, we kind of have to understand what we're talking about. So now I have to immerse myself in a world that, like, what kind of parental controls are there? Like, what can my kid get access to? Can my kid post? Are there filters? And, you know, all of those considerations. And it's just constantly changing. And as parents, we can't keep up. It is having a big effect. It's distracting our, like, from just even general, like, it's distracting our kids. We're always on it. It's distracting ourselves, the amount of time I spend, and I need to constantly control my social media use.
And it's very addictive too. Yeah. Like, it's so addictive.
Yeah. Especially for, like, an underdeveloped brain, right?
Yeah.
100%. And it feeds into, like, society's need to, like, that instant gratification, right? Like, we're constantly absorbing new information and we're switching whenever we get bored. We're just constantly moving. And so, you know, when I think about, we know that it's challenging youth. We know that there are, you know, unrealistic imagery being posted on social media. So now you have kids growing up thinking this is what real life looks like for some people, when we know what actually gets posted is only what a person wants you to see, not what is. So all of those factors are complicated. And so, you know, a lot of people say, like, at what age do I give my kid access to social media? And for me, and based on kind of my knowledge and, like, my then brain is, like, my perspective as a parent is, it's not so much an age. It's more as, like, developmental milestones. Has my kid developed in a way that allows them to critically assess what they're looking at? So I look at, you know, the age that I might allow my daughter may be very different than the age I allow my son, just because even now the developmental trajectory is completely different. And we just know that people develop at different rates. So can a growing child, a developing adolescent brain, understand the risks associated with social media? Can they understand the repercussions of what you post? Like, things stay on the internet forever. Can we understand that what we see isn't always a representation of reality? Like, our ability to critically assess what we look at is really important, and something that develops way later. And we also have, you know, developing mind that has impulse control issues and all of that. So you see all of these trends coming on TikTok or what have you, and kids doing things that you're like, no, that's dangerous. Right. And all of these.
Yeah. And some crazy was kind of, out there.
Yeah.
Like, a spectrum of, like, this is kind of ridiculous to this is seriously dangerous.
Super dangerous. Yeah.
So being able to have those conversations are really important.
Yeah. Do those companies have a responsibility to, like, provide a safe space for their users, or their, you know what I'm saying?
They're in, like, court right now. Meta's in court right now because they figured out that, like, because they wanted to put out Instagram Kids. They stopped them from doing that. And there's tons of whistleblowers within the company saying they're totally aware of the risks, and they are totally aware of the things that they can do to mitigate those risks, like hiding the likes. Like, you would have to opt in to see the likes rather than automatically having the likes, and then you can opt out of seeing them. Like, 0.1% of people would opt out, but only like 30% of people would opt in to see the likes. So there are definitely things that they are aware of that they could do to safeguard, like, this a little bit.
And they're just not doing there it. Too is like,
and the content is horrific. Like sometimes
the stuff on TikTok, you're just like, how is this a safe space for kids?
It's
right?
Not.
You don't know what they're. Yeah, exactly. It's not. And they kind of have a responsibility, but I guess in a way they don't, because they're like, we made this app and it's up to you. Right.
And you can't always control someone's speech, right? Unless it infringes on, you know, like you're talking about hate speech and et cetera, yeah. et cetera. Like we have the ability to freely express ourselves. They'll argue that you signed that like terms right. of it, those agreements that nobody reads. So you don't
nobody
know.
Nobody
so
reads.
I'm sure there's something in there that says like you assume any liability, you assume
of course.
All the risks. We don't read it. We don't know, but that's how they protect themselves. I would say as a person who's worked, you know, in nicotine dependence for many years, like that's how the tobacco industry, like they knew what they were doing. And yeah. like, look how long it's taken for us to step back. And all what tobacco did was say, okay, now it's hard to catch the young folks with cigarettes. So we're going to wrap this up in something shiny and put out vapes like e-cigarettes.
Right.
And now we're getting them in a different way, right? Like it's just, there's always that creative marketing. Because it's easier to target the younger individuals because they have a longer lifespan. They're going to make more money off of the young kids right. than they will adults. It's not worth Ugh. Pursuing adults.
I know
adults,
it's horrible
right?
to think like that, but that's the thing is they're only thinking business. They yeah. don't money. Care.
Capitalism about is so gross.
I have one more question before we move on.
Yeah.
There, you must have, and maybe you can just give us a list later that we can include, but resources or books that parents can read about social media or how to navigate that space or how to talk to your child. Cause I think it's so important to have those tools.
Yeah. Yes.
Because like you said yourself, we don't really even know enough about it ourselves no. to be able to like start that conversation with our kids and like with their developing brains too on top of it. Cause it's not like you're speaking to someone.
Yeah. On the same yeah. wavelength as you necessarily. Yeah. So if you have books or any articles or something, we would love to. We can just put them in the show notes. If you're listening to this yeah. episode, they'll be in the show notes. You can yeah. click on them because I think that's huge for parents.
Yeah.
Shall we switch gears?
Yes, we're going to switch gears and ask you another question, even though clearly we could talk about social media.
I know.
We've been up against it for a long time.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about lockdowns and school closures. That was a fun time. I think I'm still traumatized from that.
Me too.
What effect has that whole debacle had on the mental health of kids and teens? What are you seeing in your office? And what can parents do to support the kids who are deeply and negatively affected by school closures? Because there was a lot of kids that were having a hard time virtually. And Absolutely. I don't blame them, by the way. Like they're like classes like phys ed online was like yeah. mind blowing to me. My son was like, do I have to do this? They're making me dance. And I'm like, just go outside.
Yeah.
Like at this point, it's better if you get
sit outside. Like, go run around. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Go run around the block.
So this is one of those things where I don't think we're going to see, I fully understand the consequences of all of that for a while because some mm-hmm. of those things don't come immediately or some things come immediately. Others we'll see over time. And there's tons of research being conducted right now to look at. And there was lots of research happening during the pandemic to kind of assess mental health. And I'll say not just our kids, ourselves, right? And mm-hmm. this is now what makes it even more complicated issue because you have families as a whole who are struggling. And so right. then that impacts your ability to support your kid because you're also struggling. And how do you manage that? And, you know, we're seeing certainly heightened rates of anxiety, especially health anxiety, because just kind of the fear around getting sick and just grief and trauma around those who lost individuals during that time, lost individuals in ways that they yeah. didn't get to process their grief. Like people lost family members in a hospital and couldn't see them, couldn't attend, like all of the ways that
so awful.
We had to deal with like a switch that happened like that. And
yeah, nobody was ready for it.
Yeah.
Nobody's like it was and so we can never be, even if we can prepare, you know, working in a hospital, you can have pandemic protocols. We have pandemic right. protocols and you still have to change them and you have to update them. So now we have new pandemic protocols, but you know, this is just kind of a thing that we can't anticipate. And there were kids that were isolated or folks that were stuck in homes that have challenges in them, right? You might deal yeah. with homes that are dealing with, you know, domestic situations and folks that were just kind of exposed to things that maybe the distraction of everyday life helped to put the spotlight away from. So this kind of brought light to a lot of things and created a lot of stress and anxiety and isolation. And then we come out of it with a healthcare system that is not equipped to support everybody, right? Like this, mm-hmm. this now, and I can complain for days about how our healthcare system is just still needs a lot of work to be able to support the mental health side. Anybody who's tried to reach out and get support for mental health services know that wait lists for anything publicly funded are years long, and some of them closed because the wait list is too long. So then you're dealing with issues of access, and then access and privilege, right? Who has access to be able to get to private care and pay for it, which then you're talking about those who are already at higher risk because of, you know, all the social determinants of health and all of those considerations. Now you're kind of getting this like tiered system, right? And it becomes really challenging. So we are seeing it. The healthcare system really has a lot of work to be done. There are free resources like self-help resources, online resources that folks can access to support. But what we're seeing, like, we're truly not going to understand for a while, but we do know there is an impact. We do know that, you know, even all my colleagues in private practice, like, all of them suddenly began having huge wait lists because there's just such a high demand and not enough supply.
So much was going on. And like you said, the family dynamics for sure were changing at home because people were dealing also with their marriages, with their livelihood, with their jobs and stuff like that. They're trying to support their kids in virtual. And like you said, for a lot of those kids, like, the school was the safe space. They were going there to leave their homes to be, like, some of them were getting breakfast there and things like that. And so that was really scary too, to think about those kids.
Yeah. But what does a parent do? Like, you know, your teen is going through something, you know, that it's related to the fact that they'd been isolated. Maybe it is health anxiety or whatever. Like, if you are like, you go to this website and you try to get your kid help and there's a huge wait list, what do you do as a parent in that situation? Like, how do you help as a parent?
I'll always kind of have a first similar response to questions like these. And one is, we want to look at helping our kids in a couple of ways. One is, does our kid want to, depending on their age too, I think we want to consider what our approach looks like. But if our kid's struggling, does our kid talk to us about it? Do they want to hear from us? We want to support, but you also can't, for lack of a better way,
force
solutions down our kids' throats, right? We want to create, I think step one is creating spaces to have open, safe conversations, not our parental instinct to like, I have to protect my kid. I need to force them to get what they need because I'm scared, and I'm scared to do the wrong thing. And I'm scared to, you know, if I don't address it, then I'm ignoring it. And if I'm ignoring it and something happens, I'm going to blame myself and my kid's going to struggle and all. And we, this parental guilt, this mom guilt, this, you know, person guilt that we have around being guardians of kids, and we get scared and it almost prevents us from doing something. And I think we want to create our spaces in the home just to be able to talk about, you know, if we're talking about younger kids, let's start giving our children the opportunity to understand how to speak about how they're feeling. Let's give them the language to talk about their emotions, give them the language. And that's what I practice with my anxious daughter, who takes after her very anxious mother, who like, you know, I can see the anxiety and I want to just be like, do this, because I know that works for me, and like shove my solutions at her. Really, step one is getting her to recognize what she's struggling with and being able to name it. When she can name it, I can give her that space to be vulnerable and talk about it. So step one is, are we creating the spaces to talk about it? Are we taking away the stigma and shame that sometimes comes with the way that we feel? And we may be creating, say, a space that's not comfortable for a child to come talk to us without even realizing it, right? Just how we talk about mental health. So being open about talking about mental health, about our own. So I'll talk to my daughter about when I'm feeling anxious, to let her know that it's okay to feel those things. And there are ways that we can help deal with it.
It's important not to try to control the situation so much as adults too, and like put your narrative on it instead of just hearing them out. It's very hard for people to do, but that's a very important thing to practice.
Yeah.
It's just let them speak the way, because then they'll feel safe telling you things and they'll feel that friendship and bond between you. If you're constantly like do this, like to your point, what you said, do this or do that, or interrupting them and saying, well, what you're feeling is probably this, then you're not really helping them much, right? You're not really listening.
Oh, the joys.
Oh, the joys of emotional labor.
We thought it was bad when they were newborns. So we're like, this is so hard. And then we're like, oh, shit.
Remember all the moms laughed at us? They're like, you just wait. It just never gets easier, I don't think. That's the thing. It's just different challenges. And then it doesn't get easier, but you get better is what we say. And you grow along with your kids, you know?
Yeah, it doesn't get easier. You get better and you learn, right? You learn to get, like, it's not about you needing to know everything, and it's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to own up to those mistakes and work with your child as opposed to trying to like direct. I think especially as they get older, like what teenager wants to be told what to do?
No,
from anybody.
No,
certainly not by their parents.
No. And I think parents are just so used to micromanaging too. You got to get out of that habit,
but you have to micromanage them when they're little.
Yes.
That's the thing. It's like, you don't have a choice but to micromanage your kid up until they're like seven.
Yeah.
And then how do you let go of that role? Like, you're that's the only thing you've ever done with them.
Stay conscious of it and like stay hyper aware of your conversations. I'm like, we're trying to do that at home too, is like really pay attention to our language, give them the space, make them feel like it's safe to say anything. There's no wrong answers, no wrong feelings. Whatever you feel is valid, and just saying things like that. And kids understand more than we give them credit for sometimes. Like, 100%. My son is 9, and sometimes I think, okay, maybe he might not understand it, but I'm going to still say it the way I mean it, and it's going to be genuine and authentic. And it he gets it. It stays in there somewhere. And you know,
and that's how they learn.
I feel like for my family, yes. But I feel like with my family, what I fall back on a lot, and Myra, you know my family because we grew up together, but my parents are awesome. Hmm. My grandmother is still alive. My kids will benefit from having like a whole community of people that if they don't feel like they can come and talk to me about something, maybe they can go and talk to their grandpa about it. Maybe they can go and talk to their auntie about it. Maybe they can, you know, there's going to be.
I'm just visualizing your whole family stepping in and just being also like, what do you guys want? Anything will make you like the most delicious treat for this conversation.
That helps. The cookies always help. Cookies first. And then the conversation flows, right?
Whatever helps.
But yes, I mean, just use every resource you have possible. I think you don't have to do this all by yourself.
Absolutely. And lean on your friends and other moms in your community. I find that helpful too. Yeah. I live in a great community of like parents and like his friends' parents that I didn't necessarily grow up with, or I wasn't friends with for a long time, but they're great because sometimes your kids open up around other people.
Yeah.
And so if you have those relationships, good.
And remembering to, you know, like, if you have that network, making sure your network kind of understands your approach too, and like creating that similar messaging and approach across the board.
Find your people.
Talk like the conversations I have with my parents to say, like, I know you did differently, but this is how you're doing it, and I need you to be consistent. I need you to not use that type of language around eating and food, and they have to sit here and like, this is our approach and we want to be consistent. So making
it's tough for that generation.
I know. Ooh, all of our parents are like first generation Canadian immigrants.
Tired. So that's their favorite thing to say is you look horrible and you need to eat. It's like, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's get to audience questions because we did get a lot of submissions and I think that they were great.
Yeah, they were
great. Very varied. Question one was, I think my daughter, age 14, is developing disordered eating habits. How do I talk about it with her?
So I have lots of follow-up questions. So my first question is,
I have no answers for you.
So to the person or individuals who are kind of in similar situations, first thing you kind of want to ask yourself is what tells me that? What information am I seeing that suggests to me that this might be the case? The next question I'd ask myself is, what environment do I have in my home to talk about it? How do we talk about food in the house? So that I can also go down a very long tangent, but I'll kind of say, you know, can we talk openly about food? How do we perceive weight? Because obviously a lot of things around disordered eating have to do with weight. You know, do we talk about weight loss? You know, something I reflect on a lot too is, a person who grew up struggling with their weight a lot. So I'm very conscious of the language that I use with my kids, because I know that if I create an environment similar to, you know, the one that I was in and the way society puts it around us, that I might help create that environment where someone struggles or has issues around their, you know, eating, food, weight, body image, et cetera. So I would try to understand the facts around the situation and then create the space to talk to your child about what you see. What are you noticing? Oftentimes it's really hard. Like, how do I start? How do I even approach my child? And
because you don't want to accuse them of anything or make them feel ashamed or something.
Yeah, no shame.
And we don't want to make assumptions, right?
Right.
Maybe I'm going to throw out an example. Maybe you've been noticing it for a week and your child has just been dealing with a huge stomach ache because maybe there's something else going on, or maybe they're, constipated. I don't know. And there might be a reason.
Or anxious, I guess. Because anxiety can, I know for me, when I'm anxious, I don't want to eat anything.
Me either. That's the first thing that goes is appetite.
Yeah.
100%. And then all of the side effects that come with that. So we don't want to make assumptions. So when we approach, you know, our child, we want to just say like, oh, I've noticed that. And you stick to facts, not what we believe that fact to mean, but just what we see. Say, you know,
that's very
important. Hey, we've noticed, you know, I noticed that you haven't really been eating your dinner lately. You know, can you tell me a little bit about, like, have you been liking what I've been making? Do you want to be more involved? Like, engage in the conversation. Let's not assume that it's one thing. It may be, but it may also not be. And we as parents are kind of hypervigilant and scared for a kid to struggle. So
we always think of the worst scenario, right? Yeah. And if you go to the worst scenario and that's not the truth, then they're like anxious about something that wasn't even on their mind before. They're like, wait, do I have this problem?
Right. Yeah.
Now I'm stressing my parents out. You know, depending on the child you have, they might then get stressed out that they're making you stressed out, right? And take on your burden.
Oh my God.
Just check me right out.
No easy way around parenting, guys.
No, and I think the one thing I'll say to that comment is that there is no easy way. There also, like, if we try to focus on doing things perfectly or not making a mistake, we're never going to approach our kids. We need to be able to trust that we come from the right place, try to put in some strategies and know, like, I was about to curse.
You're totally allowed to curse.
We bleep it out.
So if we fuck up, then we just own up to it with our kids, right? Like, you know what? I was asking you a bunch of questions about your eating earlier, and you know what? It didn't come out the way I wanted to. Listen, I want to be able to talk about it. Can we start over? And giving some time, right? It's okay to make mistakes. And I think we actually teach our kids skills that way too.
Absolutely.
We can own up to it, backtrack and try again. We let our kids know that mistakes are part of life and we're going to work together to deal with it. And I think, so again, kind of going back to the disordered eating or concerns around it, stick to the facts. If now we're talking about what we're seeing is like dramatic weight loss, we're seeing, or, you know, depending on the type of disordered eating, right? You're seeing someone go to the bathroom, every time they eat, or concerning behaviors, that's when I say healthcare provider. Take them to a healthcare provider to get properly assessed, because disordered eating behavior, especially if we're talking about diagnosed disordered eating, like that's not, we don't want to mess with that. We want to get treatment, like get support. So we want to make sure we have open conversations to get our kids willing to get some support, because these are one of the toughest things to deal with. And it's a spectrum. A lot of what people deal with are disordered eating behaviors, not necessarily eating disorders. Mm. And so what we want to do is try to address the behavior when it's kind of on this side of the spectrum, because sometimes it can then develop to something a bit more. So keeping that open dialogue is really, really important. And being mindful as parents, how we talk about food, how we talk about appearance, how we talk about weight in the household can make a difference in our child's willingness to talk to us, but in our child's perception of what our bodies should look like. And even just in our materials that we show, are we diversifying like the imagery we see so that kids understand that people look different and that's okay?
I think I read something somewhere about kind of having meaningful meals and talking about that. And I started telling my son too, like, instead of just putting a plate in front of him and then like, I'm eating, but I'm on my phone, and he's eating, but he's watching TV, and we're just shoving food into our face. Like, take a minute to look at what it is, who prepared it, how it got there. Like, those avocados definitely did not come from Ontario. How did they get here? You know, and like, have a moment with it, like connect with the actual food that you're eating, mm-hmm. and be conscious of it. I think makes a huge difference, because then it kind of places it in a more...
You're such a good mom, babe.
I try. I only try. We do the best we can.
I know. Exactly.
And that's all we can do.
Okay. We're going to talk to you forever. Yeah, I know. Like, anyway.
Okay. So question number two is ADHD in a 13-year-old. How do I capture their attention, interest, or participation without sounding, quote, annoying?
Annoying.
I'm sure that's what word got thrown at that mom by, by said child. Yeah.
So I'll start off similarly in asking the question, like, is this a diagnosed ADHD or is this assumed based on behaviors we're observing? Because if it's a 13-year-old that's been diagnosed with ADHD and they're really struggling with attention, then I would say, is that is it being addressed? Like, have we spoken to a healthcare mm-hmm. provider? Generally, recommendation at that age would be some behavioral support and potentially some medications to help. For like a 13-year-old. So if we're talking about that, I would say, and you're seeking treatment and it's not working, go back to your healthcare provider or lean on some of those behavior strategies that hopefully your healthcare provider would supported you in getting access to.
If your child has been diagnosed, you're saying, right? If you brought your child in and they've been diagnosed, you should have left with some materials.
The key word is should have, and this is where
back to healthcare.
Back to healthcare and back to the importance of really advocating, right? Like, we as parents for ourselves and our kids really need to be able to advocate, which is frustrating because it also assumes you have a certain level of knowledge in order to be able to advocate, which then deals with privilege and again, goes back to a lot of issues around that. But if we're talking about behaviors we're noticing and, we're struggling to get our kids' attention, I think, what are the circumstances happening around trying to get our child's attention? And also ask your kid, say, sometimes I find, like, not when their kids, not when they're upset, not when they're activated, but just say, sometimes when I'm trying to talk to you, I feel like it's really hard. And you said that I'm annoying you. And you know what? That's really not my intention. What do you think is the best way for me to talk to you when you're busy, if I need to get your attention?
That's a good way of doing it, because then you're giving them. Yeah, exactly.
Make them part of the solution.
You're taking their strategies instead of us assuming, because I can give some suggestions, but each kid is different. And I think it's worth empowering the kid to come up with their solution, so that then I would use their words, say, I don't want to be annoying. I want to be able to talk to you. And sometimes I think we're missing each other. So what do you think is the best? And go from there. Like, let your child lead. They don't get very many opportunities for control, even at 13, right? So taking opportunities to let them feel like they can direct you is actually very empowering and kind of creates opportunities for that dialogue.
I think that's great advice. So what is going on with these learning disabilities in general?
Why is it so common?
Is it so common to see kids getting diagnosed with ADD, ADHD? Like, is this just a matter of more awareness and people are advocating for that kind of stuff? And so the diagnoses are coming in.
Yeah. Or is it the state of our world?
Or is it just like we're fucked?
Yeah.
So, the state of the world part is hard for us to measure, understand.
Yeah. Quantify.
What we can say is that it makes sense that the rates have increased for a few reasons. One, because the metrics we use to diagnose, physicians and stuff will use the DSM, the Diagnostics and Statistical Manual, and their new versions get released, every however many years. And the criteria to diagnose has changed, and it's become, and the more we understand of, for example, ADHD, ADD, ADHD, the more we're able to better diagnose. So we've given ourselves in the healthcare community better language and tools to be able to diagnose. So the better we're able to do it, the more we're going to catch.
Which is amazing.
And that, in tandem with we still have a long way to go, but in tandem with like the destigmatization around mental health, right? And issues like someone who's diagnosed with ADHD now, you know, maybe 20 years ago would have just been like that troublemaker kid.
I was going to say, like, what was going on in the 80s and 90s with any kid that had ADHD?
They were at the office. They were just they got sent to the office. They were standing in the hall. Yeah.
They were getting in
trouble. Crazy to think about.
Yeah.
So we have more means to understand it. More now, parents also are more informed. So they, instead of saying, working with the school and saying, look, my kid's a trouble, you know, school saying your kid's a troublemaker, us, you know, dealing with our kids with consequences. We now have language to go to our physicians and healthcare professionals and say, listen, this is what I'm noticing. Can we explore this a little bit more? So we know more, and inevitably we can, the more we track things, and the more information we gather, we inevitably start to see an increase in rates.
Diagnoses.
I think Myra needs to hang out with Rocco.
I know.
You should be my son. We need to see if he's a troublemaker. He's an actual troublemaker, but he's
very charming, and he gets himself out of it
he's
every single time.
He's mischievous. So and adorable. Okay. Question number three from our community is, my daughter is a high performance athlete. She also pulls out her eyelashes. Best way to tackle this. I haven't even heard of that as a,
it's, I know that there's
actually a
trick. Exactly. Yes. Cause people can like pull the back of their hairs.
Like or from like stress, eyebrows. I guess.
Yeah. Or eyebrows. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, so I'll start with a similar question is this now something that like hair pulling, are we talking about trichotillomania, which is a diagnosed kind of condition, or, you know, so how do we know that? How do we know if we should see a doctor? Like, are we, do we have no eyelashes? Like, have we pulled everything out, or is it like picking? Are we pulling or picking? What does that look like? Is it, and a lot of the diagnosed conditions kind of, center on, like, is it impacting our life? Like, is it impacting our ability to do things? So are we, is the pulling super distracting, causing distress? Then I say speak to a healthcare provider. Additionally, someone can pull at their eyelashes, or I'll use myself as an example. I'll like pick at my thumbs when I'm anxious. That's like a thing that I do, and it's tied to my anxiety. So it's a symptom of my anxiety, not necessarily like a condition in and of itself. So understanding what are the circumstances in which that behavior happens. Is it kind of all the time? Or is it when there are super anxious situations? And a high performing athlete, I don't think would be hard to find circumstances that would be really anxiety provoking. So how do we bring it up with our kid if, say, it's not a diagnosed thing? Is saying, you know, when you see your kid kind of pulling at their eyelashes or doing something that suggests to you that they may be anxious, not necessarily speaking to the specific behavior, say, you know, how are you, if it's related to something you think they're anxious about, like, how are you feeling about that race? Like, are you feeling, you know, what, tell me a little bit about how you're feeling, and try to adjust what they may be feeling without necessarily pointing out the behavior to understand it a little bit more, because there may be shame or distress around the fact that they're pulling, or if they've kind of lost their eyelashes, et cetera. But I would say this is around any anxious behavior, not just eyelashes, right? Just trying, it's telling
you
something.
Everyone has their things, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Use it as like a form of
And sometimes it's a condition, and sometimes it's an anxious response. So let's try to understand what's causing it, and then work through dealing with it. Like, what are some tools we can do that maybe are less harmful to, you know, eyelashes serve a purpose, right? So what are some conditions that, or things that we can do that potentially are less harmful or risky.
Okay. I think that's great advice.
Yeah, absolutely.
We probably have time for one more question. I actually love this question because I just think that it was such a beautiful thing for somebody to reach out with. But somebody asked, can you give some advice on how aunts and uncles can connect with their teenage nieces and nephews these days?
Yeah.
What a nice on question. TikTok.
I know. I just thought that was so beautiful. Yeah, exactly. You got to get on TikTok. And
my immediate thought is like paying attention to what they're interested in, asking questions related to their areas of interest. I think maybe not trying to like be the cool aunt or uncle, but just like being the person who listens and is curious and wants to know about what's going on in that child's life. Like just being the person who listens, doesn't kind of try to control or tell the child what to do, just like they live with their parents and they live with society is always telling them what to do, right? Like I think a big key to connection, you, as parents or aunts and uncles, family members, friends, you know, or your chosen family, is really like taking the time to listen, ask from a genuinely curious perspective. Questions, not like I'm trying to find out what you're doing because I want to tell you you're doing it wrong, but I
or tell your mom. And they're also like, you're gonna tell my mom. Like they're like, so they're conscious of that too. But to, like, I think that's the best play is like what they're interested in already. Start talking to them about that. Build a friendship with them and let them just talk. Sometimes it's about just waiting it out and letting them have the conversation with you instead of controlling it yourself. And then all kinds of things come out from that.
And that kind of goes to every single thing we've spoken about is like approach it with like curiosity.
Yeah.
And know that like kids are struggling in lots of ways and it's so hard not to want to fix everything. And just really understanding that whenever we can help empower kids and give them language and give them space and safe spaces to talk, we're more likely to get that engagement. So it's really hard because it fights our natural instinct to protect our kids or to protect our nieces and nephews. And just really understanding that the more we try to connect from where they are at, the better long-term success you have. And I would say for those aunts and uncles, be in open communication with the parents too, because if you're finding that the kids are only coming to you and don't want you to tell anything to the parents, you may want to say, Hey, sister, like maybe work on creating opportunities to have open conversations and like try to get that consistency, because it's great that they want to talk to aunt and uncle and we want them to be able to have that space, safe space everywhere as well. So like, you know, team approach to supporting youth, especially in their teenage years.
Yeah.
Oh, the hot teens. Tip.
I know it's coming. The teens, we're they're just staring like, down the barrel, know, Myra.
They, and
it's
they don't
like
want
it's
anything
coming.
To do with you at that no. point either. They're just no. like, please leave
peer
me alone.
Influence really in like early to mid adolescence, like the influence of peers just like go like skyrockets. Smush parental influence. Kids, when they're like younger, you have great influence.
That's why you got to do the work now so that it sticks around for later.
Yeah. Give them the skills.
What age does that switch over? Are you seeing?
Well,
how much longer do I have? Like.
So this is one of the things where, I mean, you like you have general age groups where you're going to say like the preteen age where they're going to start to see more of a shift in influence, the tweens. But this is developmental too, right? Like it really depends and it depends on the relationship and the foundation that you create with your kids as well. So trying to be really intentional about when you're with your kids, you're there. And that's something we struggle with, like with computers and phones and everything distracting us all the time, but really trying to be present with our kids and build those foundations, because there is going to be a time when we don't hold that much influence. But if we create that dialogue, they're still going to want to come to us.
Yeah. Oh, that makes me feel a little emotional.
That's a good way of kind of closing this.
Yeah, I think so too. That was amazing. Myra, thank you so much
to you
for
so
joining
much
us
more.
Today.
We're going to be calling you when our kids are tweens, which is very soon.
Help. It's frightening. My oldest is 5 and I'm literally dreading the days when I have to start engaging conversations about cell phones and social media. Like I'm
already there. Like my kid's 9 and that's what I mean is like, I just keep trying to build on that foundation that he feels good enough to talk to me always. And that it's open conversations about anything and everything. So that later when inevitably he wants to have nothing to do with me, he'll still know I'm a safe space if he needs me. That's all I need him to know, you know?
And we're hoping that because we work in social media, our kids will automatically think it's boring and stupid and they'll like rebel by not being on
social
media.
Maybe that's the key.
No, he said to me, you're so embarrassing. And I said, I'm literally the coolest. Like, look at the rebel mama. And he goes, I know you're cool, but you're embarrassing. It's two different things. And I was like, okay, I'm cool and embarrassing. So there you go. Yeah.
Smart kid differentiating it.
Hopefully you've inspired him to stay far off of Instagram. So he doesn't have to see your embarrassing.
It's not going to be Instagram for them anyway.
I know. God help us. That's the thing too. Maybe we need to get on all the platforms. And now we're on TikTok. And now we're on Snapchat. And now we're on everything else.
It's just like too much for me. I don't even care about it enough. I don't have the desire. I just don't care.
To get on more platforms.
Like, it's too much.
Somebody tells me about a new thing and I'm like, and everyone's excited about it. I'm like,
we're not doing that.
I shut down.
Yeah.
You're like, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah, like, exactly.
We still had cassette tapes.
Yeah.
Anyways,
Myra, where can people find you if they want to follow along on your expeditions?
Well, I feel like just kind of contacting me directly. I don't have any specific social, speaking about social media, I don't have any.
I know, we just shit all over it. So,
so she's like, just text me.
You know, I have a kind of private clinical practice. I'm happy to share my contact information if folks want, have questions or need resources. Totally.
Can we link to your practice in the show notes?
Sure. Although I will say, like many of my colleagues, we're a bit full right now. Because it's also like right
please
now,
don't reach
it's
out
like,
to me.
It's my side on top of other things. So, but I can most certainly you can share my email address. And if folks reach out to you and say like, I'd like to connect with resources, I'm happy it's a hard system to navigate. So I know
that would be amazing.
And whatever resources you give us, we can definitely put together in one shot. We can share it in stories. Yeah. We'd love to share that with our community because it's so important. So
yeah. If we can support you in any way, you let us know too.
Yeah. Thank you. And
I'm happy
to support the community. It's fucking hard being a parent.
I know. Yeah. We know. Trust us.
It was much easier when we had hypothetical children.
Yes. Hypothetical kids are the best.
Yeah. They really are.
Yeah. Myra, thank you so much for your time. It was so nice seeing you
again.
Thank
you. Nice seeing you too. Thank you for having me.
We'll do it in person next time.
Yeah, for sure.
And also thanks to Nyx for being an important part of this episode. Remember to use code REBEL10 for 10% off when you shop online at nyx.ca.
We'd also love it if you could take a quick second to like, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen. You can follow the show by clicking on the little plus sign at the top of your screen if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, or click the subscribe button on the other screening services. Doing so will help us reach more people with these important conversations. So thank you in advance. We love you. Please share.
This podcast was produced by Space Monkey inside the Soda Studio. The song you're listening to is called Name and Number off the debut album Unrequited by Roshan. Stream it now on Apple Music.